Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Richard Waters, the West Coast editor for the Financial Times, and I'm your moderator for today's program. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce today's special guest, Dr. Barry Eichengreen, who is the Professor of Economics and Political Science at the University of California at Berkeley. And he's the author of the new book, Hall of Mirrors, The Great Depression, The Great Recession, and the Uses and Misuses of History. If anyone is well suited to applying the sort of sweeping historical and international perspective that a subject like this demands, then it's Professor Eichengreen. Since he first discovered a real passion for history as an undergraduate at St. Andrews University in Scotland, it's something that's defined his career as a professor at Harvard for 7 years and then at UC Berkeley as a professor since 1987. The subjects tackled in his previous books point to the range of his interests. They've included the rise of the Korean economy, the world economy after the financial crisis, and the future of the international monetary system. And as a senior advisor to the IMF, he had particular insight into that during a previous financial crisis, the Asian financial crisis of the 1990s. His interest in history is also evident. He's a past president of the Economic History Association. Now, although I'm sure Professor Eichengreen would be the first to warn us against the dangers of reaching too easy answers from a study of the crisis that we've just been through, in his latest book, he quotes George Bernard Shaw as saying, "If you laid all the economists in the world end to end, they still wouldn't reach a conclusion." And indeed, all the economists and politicians are still arguing over exactly the right responses to that last financial crisis we've just been through, and perhaps more importantly, what to do to prevent the next one. Professor Eichengreen's book has been hailed as a scholarly and a significant contribution to that debate, not least in the Financial Times, where it was described as highly readable. That review concluded, "Hall of Mirrors is destined to change the way we think about both the Great Depression and the Great Recession." Please welcome Professor Barry Eichengreen.
Thank you, Richard. Highly readable is perhaps not the strongest compliment an author can hope for, but it's a considerable achievement for an economist. Thank you to Richard Waters. Thank you to the Commonwealth Club. Thank you to the members of the audience for turning out on a lovely evening when there are also other things to do. You're probably thinking, oh no, not another book on the financial crisis. There have been previous books on our financial crisis, and we learned today that there will be another book, that Mr. Bernanke's book on the financial crisis will appear in October. I feel so my book is not the first one on the financial crisis, but neither will it be the last. I feel some obligation, I think, to explain why I felt compelled to write this book on the crisis. First, I think with the passage of time, it becomes possible to put our crisis in more of a historical perspective. When we were living through it, I can remember living through the events of 2008 and feeling an overwhelming sense of panic about what was happening to the financial system, what might happen to the economy, what might happen to us. We can view those events now with a bit more detachment, I think, and begin to understand how our crisis fits into the broader history of financial crises. And secondly, I think with the passage of time, it becomes possible to laugh as well as to cry over some of the things we witnessed and events through which we passed. So I do deploy my somewhat ghoulish sense of humor in the book in beginning to describe some of those events. Why Hall of Mirrors? I wish I could claim that I had that Hall of Mirrors in the palace at Versailles, where in 1919 Germany was saddled with an immensely heavy debt burden, of which it was then relieved at the London Debt Conference of 1953, a set of events that is highly relevant today as we discuss the possibilities of Germany extending debt relief to another troubled economy, Greece. But by Hall of Mirrors, I really had in mind the reciprocal relationship between the two great financial crises of the last century, the Great Depression of 1929-1933, and our Great Recession of 2008-2009. The book is about how the experience of the Great Depression, the lessons of the Great Depression as distilled by subsequent economists and historians, powerfully informed and shaped the response to our Great Recession. And it's about how, now having lived through our own crisis, how the experience of the Great Recession will change how we think and write, and some of us teach, about the Great Depression of the 1930s. It's about why recovery from the Great Recession hasn't been more complete. It's about why post-crisis financial reform hasn't been more ambitious and successful. And it's about how we got into this mess in the first place. So let me start with history. History is a lens through which we, by which I mean both the informed public and our elected and appointed officials, view current problems. And the power of historical experience, the logic of historical analogy, is never more compelling than during crises. Crises are when there is no time for careful analytical reasoning. Crises are when there is no time for formal model building of the sort to which economists are otherwise inclined. Crises are when there is no time for testing the fitness of an economic model against data. Foreign policy specialists have long made this point. They've pointed to the power, for example, of the Munich analogy in shaping President Truman's decision to intervene in Korea. So it was, I would argue, with the Great Recession of 2008-2009 and the Great Depression of 1929-1933, as I described a moment ago, the two great financial crises of the past century. There's absolutely no doubt that conventional wisdom about that earlier episode, what are referred to colloquially as the lessons of the Great Depression, powerfully shaped the response to the crisis of 2008-2009. In particular, the decisions of our policymakers were powerfully informed by received wisdom about the mistakes of their predecessors. In the 1930s, when that earlier crisis hit, those predecessors had succumbed to the protectionist temptation. They had cut public spending at the worst possible time, when private spending was also collapsing. They had failed to stabilize the money supply. They had neglected their responsibility for financial stability. They had failed to provide emergency liquidity to the banks. The result was collapsing banks, collapsing prices, collapsing trade, and collapsing economic activity, in a phrase, the great macroeconomic catastrophe of modern times. That this earlier crisis had reflected disastrous but entirely avoidable policy failures became conventional wisdom, courtesy of influential scholarship like Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz's Monetary History of the United States, in which they had a short 110-page chapter about what they called the Great Contraction of the 1930s. Policymakers like Chairman Bernanke, Christina Romer, the chair of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors, had read this book. They were aware of its lessons and vowed to do better. If the failure of their predecessors to provide emergency liquidity had produced a cataclysmic banking and financial crisis, then this time, instead, they would flood financial markets with liquidity and otherwise provide emergency assistance to the banks. If failure to stabilize the money supply had resulted in a disastrous deflation, then this time they would cut interest rates to zero and otherwise expand central bank balance sheets. If efforts to balance budgets had worsened the earlier slump, then this time, instead, they would apply fiscal stimulus. And as a result of this very different response, unemployment in the United States peaked at only 10%. So 10% is painfully high, but it was significantly lower than the 25% unemployment rate reached in 1933. This time, failed banks numbered only in the hundreds, not in the thousands as they had in the 1930s. To be sure, financial dislocations were widespread, but the complete and utter collapse of financial markets, as occurred in the 1930s when FDR, as his first action on assuming office, was to close down the entire U.S. banking and financial system for 2 weeks. That complete and utter collapse was successfully averted. And what was true of the United States was true elsewhere also. So I write in the book, every unhappy country is unhappy in its own way, and there were varying degrees of economic unhappiness starting in 2008, but a few ill-starred southern European countries, notwithstanding to the contrary, that unhappiness did not rise to 1930s levels because policy this time was better. The decline in output and employment, the social dislocations, and the human pain and suffering were all less. That's the happy narrative, which, unfortunately, I would argue, is a bit too happy, a bit too easy. For one thing, it's hard to square with our collective failure to anticipate the risks. This is a point that Queen Elizabeth II famously put to the assembled economists on a visit to the London School of Economics in 2008. Why didn't you see it coming? She asked the economists in her audience. A few of those economists later wrote the Queen a letter, and they claimed that they or some of their colleagues had, in fact, seen it coming. But I think if you read what those people had been writing before the fact, they had been warning of a different crisis than the one we, in fact, suffered, a dollar crash or something like that. Or they'd simply been issuing the kind of vague, nonspecific warnings that economists are prone to issuing. So even specialists on financial crises didn't sound louder warnings. I'm supposed to be a specialist on financial crises, on the history of financial crises, and I didn't exactly see it coming, suggests adopting a somewhat less critical posture to officials in the 1920s for their failure to see it coming. Introspection of a sort that also prompted me to write this book suggests that our failure reflects what psychologists refer to as continuity bias, the subconscious tendency to think that the future will resemble the immediate past. It reflects peer pressure to conform and the costs of being ostracized if, for example, you criticized Alan Greenspan's financial stewardship, as one economist was reckless enough to do at the Federal Reserve's Jackson Hole Conference in 2005. It reflects the power of a dominant ideology, the ideology of efficient markets, and the policies of financial liberalization that flowed from that ideology. It reflects the influence of big financial institutions through their political contributions and through the revolving door between Wall Street and Washington, D.C., in shaping the policy debate. Ultimately, though, I would argue that the roots of our failure to see it coming lay in the same progressive narrative of the Great Depression that I described to you before. So recall that narrative. Entirely correctable flaws of collective decision-making had been responsible for the inability of contemporaries in the 1920s to see their crisis coming and for their failure to respond to it adequately in the 1930s. Modern-day policymakers had learned from that experience. Scientific central banking, informed by a rigorous framework that we call inflation targeting, prevented now the development of serious imbalances. Advances in supervision and regulation prevented financial excesses. Deposit insurance had been put in place in the United States and subsequently in other countries, precisely in response to the bank panics and runs by retail depositors that caused wave after wave of bank failures in the 1930s. Conventional wisdom about the Great Depression, that it was caused by entirely avoidable policy failures, was itself conducive to the belief that those failures could be and indeed had been corrected, and it followed from that belief that no comparable crisis was possible now. All of which we now appreciate was dreadfully wrong. Part of the problem, I would argue, is that we, this time by we I mean we economic and financial historians, so that's my second mea culpa, if you will, had always done a better job of explaining the course of the Great Depression, how that slump became as deep and long as it did, how the Depression became great, than we had at explaining its onset. So part of the problem is that economists are not good at understanding business cycle turning points. We never have been, and we probably never will be. But part of the problem is that we hadn't written the history of the 1920s carefully enough. So I'm going to give you three or four observations about the 1920s. If you want to substitute decade leading up to 2008 for each of the following statements about the 1920s, feel free to do so, because the same points apply. We had failed to highlight how, in the 1920s, rapid financial innovation had combined with inadequate regulation and lax monetary policy to create dangerous financial fragilities. We had failed to explain how, in the 1920s, capital flows to one half of Europe from the other half of Europe and the rest of the world had set that continent up for a painful fall. We had failed to explain how, in the 1920s, the naive belief that advances in scientific central banking had rendered crises a thing of the past was conducive to additional risk-taking. So they called it the new era in the 1920s. We called it the Great Moderation in the decade leading up to 2008. We credited inflation targeting and modern central banking. They credited the creation of the Fed in 1914. Different specifics, same general point. I think recent experience suggests the need to write this earlier history more carefully. Had we done so earlier, we might have seen more clearly how the same factors were at work in the early 21st century. The fateful decision to let Lehman Brothers fail in September of 2008, what I would argue was the single biggest mistake of the financial crisis, also suggests looking at the 1920s differently. So Lehman Brothers failed because it was insolvent, because its managers had made bad bets. Lehman Brothers was allowed to fail because the Treasury and the Fed had doubts about whether they possessed the legal authority to rescue it. But Lehman Brothers also failed because policymakers were anxious to make a statement. They had bailed out another big investment bank, Bear Stearns, 6 months earlier. They had come in for a firestorm of criticism over that decision, and they wanted to show that they were tough and that not everybody would be rescued. I think as a result of our having lived through that, observed that experience, we or future historians will look at the Great Depression of the 1930s differently. We will be reminded that the banking crises of the 1930s reflected not simply the fact that central banks and governments didn't understand their responsibilities of lenders of last resort to the banking and financial system, but also they wanted to make a statement and protect themselves against the political criticism for which they were subjected as a result of earlier bailouts. So the great banking crisis of early 1933 that forced FDR to close down the entire U.S. financial system started in Michigan. It started and spread to the rest of the country. It started with the decision of the outgoing Hoover administration and the agency responsible, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, not to bail out the Guardian Group of banks. The Guardian Group was Henry Ford's family bank. It was actually Edsel Ford's family bank, but everybody knew where the money came from. And the decision not to bail out the Guardian Group was informed by the RFC's action 6 months earlier to bail out another important bank, Central Republic Trust, a big bank in Chicago. Central Republic was the family bank of Charles Dawes. It was called the Dawes Bank. Charles Dawes was former U.S. vice president. Charles Dawes was former president 1 week removed when the bailout occurred of the selfsame Reconstruction Finance Corporation. So you can imagine the congressional criticism to which the RFC and the administration were subjected over that decision, and they vowed in response to play tough when another big politically connected bank came to the brink in early 1933. There was also the failure this time to anticipate how disruptive the collapse of Lehman Brothers would be. And here, too, I would blame the lessons, so-called lessons, of the Great Depression. The conventional narrative about the Great Depression focuses on the disruptive impact of bank failures, failures of commercial banks, and runs on those banks by retail depositors of the sort that we see every Christmas when we watch It's a Wonderful Life. Lehman was not a deposit-taking bank. Lehman didn't have retail depositors. So it followed, if you took that Great Depression narrative literally, that Lehman's failure couldn't pose such serious problems. This view, informed by the lessons of the Great Depression, had a variety of other implications. It's why the so-called Basel or Ball Capital Accord, setting capital standards for financial institutions focused on commercial banks, deposit insurance focused on commercial banks, regulation generally focused on commercial banks, all of which led to a neglect of the so-called shadow banking system of investment banks, hedge funds, money market funds, commercial paper issuers, securitizers, until it was too late. That focus led to the neglect of Lehman's derivatives positions. It ignored the fact that wholesale creditors, other big financial institutions, could run on the bank, the result of which became what I described a couple of minutes ago as the single most serious mistake of the financial crisis, the decision to allow the uncontrolled failure of Lehman Brothers. So it was at that point, September 15th, 2008, that policymakers realized that they had a situation on their hands, that we really were on the verge of another Great Depression. So the leaders of the advanced industrial countries quickly issued a joint statement that no additional systemically important financial institution would be allowed to fail. AIG was bailed out. The Congress passed the TARP reluctantly on a second try. One after another, central banks flooded financial markets with liquidity, and governments put in place multi-billion dollar programs of fiscal stimulus. Policymakers could congratulate themselves that they had indeed successfully avoided another Great Depression. Yet the results of those policies have been less than entirely successful. As you will well know, economic recovery in the United States has been lethargic this time. A couple of quarters of rapid growth in the middle of last year, notwithstanding, the U.S. economy has expanded at only about half the rate typical of the recovery phase of the business cycle. The same is true of the country in which I'm living this year, the United Kingdom, and Europe has done even worse, experiencing not a single dip recession, but a double dip, and now a seemingly endless crisis. Why the results have been less than completely successful, I would argue, is no mystery. Starting in 2010, the US and the UK and continental Europe all took a hard right turn toward austerity. Spending under the Obama stimulus, I will remind you, peaked in fiscal year 2010 and then headed steadily downward. In 2011, the Obama administration and the Congress agreed to $1.2 trillion of spending cuts to be implemented over 10 years. In 2013 came expiration of the Bush tax cuts and the end of the Social Security contribution holiday. So we can have a discussion, we should have a discussion about the distributional consequences of some of these measures, like letting the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy expire. But I think there's no question that in combination, these measures took a big bite out of spending, out of aggregate demand, and out of economic growth. In Europe, that turn toward austerity was even more dramatic. I wouldn't dispute that there were some countries like Greece where spending was out of control and a dose of austerity was required, but the dosage to which Greece has been subjected, I think, is unprecedented in modern history. So the Greek government has cut spending and raised taxes over 4 years by what now approaches a cumulative 20% of GDP. So 20% of the Greek economy has been vaporized in the course of less than 4 years, and it's not a surprise that Greece is now experiencing a slump as deep and long as the United States experienced in the 1930s. Other countries in Europe followed suit, even the UK, which had the flexibility afforded by its own currency and its own national central bank, something the Greeks and most of the other Europeans no longer possess. Even the UK raised taxes and cut spending by a cumulative 5% of GDP. Central banks, meanwhile, were anxious to end their extraordinary policies as quickly as possible. So already in 2010, the European Central Bank concluded that its work was done and it started phasing out its unconventional policies. Even more remarkably, I remind you, the ECB actually raised interest rates twice in 2011 when Europe was still in the throes of its crisis. So if you want a simple explanation for why Europe experienced a double dip, another leg down in 2011-2012, I don't think you have to look any further. What lessons, historical or otherwise, informed this extraordinary turn of events? For central banks, of course, there was, as always, deeply ingrained fear of inflation. That fear was nowhere deeper than in Germany, given memories of two hyperinflations after World Wars I and II. And German fear translated directly into European policy, given the Bundesbank-like structure of the European Central Bank and the determination of its then French president, Jean-Claude Trichet, to demonstrate that he was as Teutonic an inflation fighter as any German. What's harder to understand, I think, is the U.S. experience. I will remind you that the Fed was unwilling to make an open-ended commitment to do what it takes to fend off deflation until QE3. The first two rounds of quantitative easing, QE1 and QE2, were both limited in size, limited in duration. The U.S. had not experienced hyperinflation in the 1920s or, as you know, at any other time in its history, but this didn't prevent overwrought commentators from warning that Weimar was right around the corner. The lessons of the 1930s, that when the economy is in near-depression conditions with interest rates near zero and ample excess capacity, the central bank can expand its balance sheet as it has without igniting inflation. Those lessons were lost from view. The more hysterical the commentary, the more loudly the Congress accused the Fed of debasing the currency, the more Federal Reserve governors then feared for their independence, which rendered them anxious to start shrinking the Fed's balance sheet toward normal levels before we had anything resembling a normal economy. In the case of fiscal policy, in the case of budgetary policy, the case for continued stimulus was weakened by its failure to deliver everything promised, whether because politicians are prone to overpromising or because the economy was in fact contracting more rapidly in late 2008, early 2009 than we knew at the time on the basis of the data available to us. There was the failure to distinguish how bad conditions were from how much worse they would have been without the policy. There was the failure to distinguish the need for medium-term consolidation from the need for spending in the short term. There was the failure to distinguish the case for fiscal consolidation in countries that needed it, like Greece, from the situation in countries with more fiscal space, like Germany. So a range of factors came together. The one thing they had in common was failure. Inevitably, failures like these have multiple causes. There was the dominance of ideology and politics over what I would regard as sensible economics. There was the inability of economists to make the case for better policies. So there's my third mea culpa, if you will. There was the tendency of economists to forget as many lessons of the 1930s as they remembered. But at the end of the day, I would argue the most powerful factor in this premature decision to abandon policies that would have done more to support the economy, that would have done more to support recovery when the economy needed support, was the simple fact that we had succeeded in preventing the worst. We had avoided another Great Depression. Policymakers could declare the emergency over. They could heed the call, the instinct to return to normal policies. So the irony, in my view, is that their very success in preventing a 1930s-like economic collapse led to their failure to support a more vigorous recovery. I would make the same argument about financial reform. In the 1930s, as I've described, the U.S. banking and financial system collapsed. The prevailing regime was discredited. The banking lobby was disenfranchised, if you will. And in that environment, we got far-reaching financial reform. We got the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated safe public utility banking from risky investment banking. We got federal deposit insurance for the first time. We got the Securities and Exchange Commission, the first time we had in the United States a federal agency to oversee the operation of stock and bond markets. Say what you will about the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act of 2010, but it's weak soup by the standards of the 1930s, and the same is true of financial reform in the UK. The same is true of financial reform in continental Europe. Why did things turn out differently? Because we avoided the complete and utter collapse of the financial system. The big banks are still around, and they've gotten bigger. The prevailing regime was not discredited to the same extent. The banking lobby was allowed to regroup and push back against more far-reaching reform. So to be clear, I'm not arguing that we should have allowed the banks to collapse. I'm not arguing that we should have allowed the economy as a result to collapse. I'm not arguing it would have been better to allow unemployment to rise to 25% as it did in the 1930s, but I am arguing that there are other unintended consequences of which we should be aware even today when we think about those actions. Finally, I should say a few words before I conclude about the situation in Europe, which is in the headlines now every day. I say in the book, the decision to create the euro in 1999 was perhaps the greatest economic policy blunder of the 20th century, a fitting way, some would say, to bring a century of great economic policy blunders to a close. But in that case, unlike the 2008 crisis, some of us like to think, to echo the Queen, that we did see it coming. I could cite chapter and verse, but in the interest of time, I won't. I would observe, though, that this decision to go ahead with the euro is another example of the misuses of history. In this case, of the ability of policymakers with an agenda to cherry-pick their historical analogies, to argue, as European policymakers did at the end of the 20th century, that financial instability and indirectly even Hitler and World War II had been caused by the competitive currency devaluations of the 1930s and not by the rigid gold standard system that preceded them in the 1920s. The implication that they drew being that the risk in the 1990s was competitive currency devaluations rather than the premature creation of a new gold standard-like system, the euro system. John F. Kennedy, when contemplating how to respond to the Cuban Missile Crisis, considered a range of historical analogies from Pearl Harbor to the 1948-49 Berlin blockade, the 1956 Suez Crisis, and tested them for fitness to the situation at hand. Exceptionally, JFK had historians like Arthur Schlesinger in his kitchen cabinet, much like Barack Obama had Christina Romer. Harry Truman, who relied only on the analogy with Munich, did not. He had one analogy, and he pushed it for all it was worth. So too did the architects of the euro, as a result of which European policymakers are still living with the consequences. So let me stop there. I'm happy to hear reactions.
Well, our thanks to Dr. Barry Eichengreen, a professor of economics and political science at the University of California at Berkeley, and author of the new book, Hall of Mirrors, The Great Depression, The Great Recession, and the Uses and Misuses of History. Now it's time for today's audience question period, and we have a number of questions piling up, so let's begin. Professor Eichengreen, it seems sometimes these days that we're in a constant cycle of financial crises. The ones that you describe in your book are 80 years apart and of historic magnitude. From the 1987 stock market crash to the 1994 bond market collapse to the 98 currency crisis in Asia and so on, it just seems that the cycles are speeding up. The volatility is getting greater, the magnitude of the crisis is getting greater, and the impact of the financial system on the real world is getting stronger. So for most listeners, I think there's a sense that, something here has gone wrong, something's out of control. Looking ahead, what confidence can we have that we can somehow break out of this cycle of crises?
The very last sentence of the book is something to the effect, I'm paraphrasing myself, the way we handled the greatest financial crisis in 80 years suggests that we will experience another financial crisis in considerably less than 80 years. So part of that is the same conclusion that I emphasized before, that success has been the mother of failure. As a result of our success in preventing another Great Depression, we have failed to address the real and especially the financial problems that gave rise to that crisis in the first place. So policymakers are running as fast as they can. Stanley Fischer, the number two at the Board of Governors of the Fed, gave a speech last week about how we may have done some things to strengthen the banks, but the problems with the shadow banking system are still out there. The problems in derivatives markets are still out there, but the problem we have is sometimes referred to as the bloodhounds and greyhounds problem, that the regulators are the bloodhounds. They're on the trail, but the greyhounds run very fast.
One of our audience asked the question, it was Warren Buffett that described derivatives as weapons of mass financial destruction. And these were the things that were touted as the great risk reducers before the crisis, that the financial system was getting safer. So from what you're saying, it sounds like we can have no comfort or confidence that things are getting are any better than they were before the last crisis. Nothing really has been done to reduce that inherent systemic risk.
I think there are three big risks in the financial system that we need to focus on. Number one, the banks, which are modestly better capitalized than before the crisis, but they still don't have enough skin in the game, their own skin in the game, to behave prudently. They still don't have enough capital to function as an adequate buffer against shocks to their balance sheets. So the banking problem is still out there, and I'm not confident that things we've done strengthen capital requirements modestly, require banks to write living wills explaining how they would be wound up if they got into trouble, are going to make much of a difference. Number two, the derivatives problem that you allude to, Richard, is still out there. We have moved the clearing of transactions and derivatives into clearinghouses. We've designated a few big banks as being responsible for clearing transactions and derivatives. I think that merely concentrates the risk in a few places rather than eliminating it. We should force derivatives onto electronic exchanges where they can be cleared in real time, and the domino effect you get when one participant in such a transaction like Lehman or AIG goes under spills over to the rest of the system, where that would be eliminated. Some people say that some derivatives are too exotic or complex or opaque to be moved onto exchanges. That sounds like a pretty good argument for regulating them out of existence. And third, there's the rating agency problem, that we still use the ratings issued by these commercial companies, Standard & Poor's, Moody's, Fitch, in financial regulation. The rating agencies are still subject to their conflict of interest, where they advise issuers about how to structure an issue so as to get a AAA rating, and then they're the ones who confer the AAA rating. So I think if that's not a conflict of interest, I don't know what one is. Where regulation now requires the CEOs of the rating agencies to attest that they're avoiding these conflicts of interest. I think that's an example of the weak soup that's Dodd-Frank. The rating agencies should be disconnected from the regulatory process entirely, and we haven't been able to do that.
Has the financial sector simply grown too big, and does it have too much influence on the real economy, if I can put it that? One of our audience members asks, you know, how much greater the financial sector became as a proportion of GDP in the latest crisis versus the 1920s, and is that a sign that finance is just too big a part of the economy?
There's a lot of evidence that the answer is yes. So there have been a series of economic studies in recent years coming from the Bank for International Settlements, coming from academics, which do suggest that financialization not only reaches the point of diminishing returns, but that in addition, it can reach the point of negative returns. So part of the issue is how big the financial system is, part of the issue is how politically influential it is, and part of the issue is what kind of financial system do we want? We want a financial system that provides services to households and individuals, that provides finance for entrepreneurs, that funds startups, that funds existing small and medium size enterprises, and we need a debate about how to structure the system so as to do that.
This crisis was preceded by an extended period of deregulation in finance. The Glass-Steagall Act repeal is the thing that most people think of, but in your book you detail many steps to this. To many people, I think this looks like political influence. It looks like Wall Street influencing policy in a detrimental way. One of our audience members, asks, should we just see this as political corruption? Isn't it just going to happen again? I mean, how do we stop financial interests influencing policy in that way?
I'm not sure that we can stop financial interests from influencing policy. All we can do is have discussions like this one. There are members of Congress who are much more sensitive to this issue, starting with Senator Warren, and one could run a longer list. So part of the answer is electing representatives who are aware of the problem.
So we all need to be aware and keep this subject in public discussion. You make the point that the fact that we recovered from the immediate crisis meant there was less pressure for re-regulation of the financial system. So imagine for a minute that you were able to wave a magic wand and restructure the financial system in a way that made it less likely we'd face catastrophic crises in the future. What would you do? Should we break up? Would you break up the big banks? Would you limit their functions? I mean, what are the more drastic things that could be done?
As I said before, I would focus on much more capital for the banks, dealing with the derivatives problem by moving them onto an exchange, and dealing with the rating agency problem. I don't want to be entirely negative about the prospects for financial reform. In fact, at the same time, the new Congress is trying to roll back some of the provisions of Dodd-Frank. There are forces pushing in the other direction. In particular, we have had this drumbeat of financial scandals. We've had the interest rate rigging scandal, the LIBOR scandal in London. We've had the foreign exchange market rigging scandal. We've had the money laundering scandal. We've had the banks' evasion of U.S. Financial sanctions on Iran and North Korea scandal. So I think this drumbeat of scandals keeps the case for financial regulation and reform alive. It reminds us that these events in financial markets are not simply the actions of a few bad apples, but there is a systematic problem of culture, or economists would say an agency problem in financial markets that needs to be addressed by regulation. So in a sense, there's hope.
Yeah. Well, we shouldn't spend all our time talking about the financial sector here. We should talk, we'll go on to talk about the real world, if you like, that we all inhabit and what the consequences are from this crisis. But just one last question that keeps coming up, and indeed has come up again from our audience questions today, which is the bailout. The fact that, you said, I think, at the beginning that we can cry but also laugh a little at, looking back at these crises now. I think there's still a lot of anger as well. And, some of the anger is around the bailout of bankers who weren't deserving. And again, we have a question here. Let's say you're right and that bailing out Lehman was right. Nonetheless, it creates incentives that are terrible incentives in the system. Won't it just lead to worse problems in future? It'll encourage risk.
Well, I think the time to install new smoke detectors in your home is not during the midst of the fire. So there is a problem that bailouts can encourage risk-taking, and that's why the argument for strengthening regulation is stronger. Another reason why it has to be stronger in the wake of this kind of crisis. But I don't think that was a point that we could afford to make in the midst of the event.
Well, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is economist and political scientist Dr. Barry Eichengreen, who's discussing lessons learned from both the Great Depression of the 1930s and the Great Recession of 2008. Well, let's talk about some of the repercussions of this financial crisis in the world that we're still living with, and one of them, I think, that's on a lot of people's minds is the massive liquidity, the cash that's been pumped into the system to try and fend off the worst effects of this. We're still living with that. One of the questions from an audience member is, how does this enormous flood of liquidity that the central banks have injected into the global financial system end? Does it end with some kind of bubble? Or does it end with some kind of gentle, soft landing where we escape it without another crisis? What do you think?
So I'm worried about the next crisis. I'm worried about Asia with its highly indebted corporations, many of whose debts are in dollars, a dollar that is becoming more expensive for them at the moment. I'm worried about Europe, which could be the trigger for financial turbulence as well. I'm worried about the shadow banking system, the derivatives markets. That's the known unknown. We don't know exactly what the problem is there, but I think we can be confident that there is one. And then there are the unknowns in what, as you described before, is a very large, very complicated, still very opaque financial system.
Plenty of things to worry about. What about the liquidity itself? Is it creating more excesses in the system? We're in San Francisco here in the midst of another tech boom. There's a lot of cash pumping back into the system, and people are starting to ask, is this what we've seen before, another stock boom, another real estate bubble? How does that end?
Yeah, so there's a lot of liquidity, a lot of cash in the system that's showing up in extraordinarily high bond prices, stock prices, real estate prices. The good news here is that the amount of leverage in the system at the same time is somewhat less. So most of us do have to put down something approaching 20% now in order to buy one of those, if we did wish to buy one of those expensive properties. You can't get a ninja loan anymore, no documentation, no down payment in the way you could before the crisis. So the fact that there may be somewhat less leverage in the system is the good news. How does it all end smoothly or with a bang? Obviously, nobody knows, and both scenarios are possible. I hope what we will see now is that central banks move gradually to drain the liquidity from the system, so there are no big interest rate surprises that could wrong foot big institutional investors and destabilize the system. And I hope central banks understand that they have two responsibilities, one for price stability, the traditional responsibility, and one for financial stability. And if they're going to try to hit two targets, they need two instruments. You can't hit two birds with one bullet unless you're very, very lucky. So they need interest rate policy to keep prices stable and the economy growing. And if they're worried about frothiness in asset markets, they need to use regulation. What the experts call macroprudential policy, but it really means regulation to address those risks in financial markets.
But this is a balancing act that is going to loom large this year. We assume that the pressure to raise interest rates will gather as the year goes on, and that the doing that without triggering at some financial accident will become a very crucial issue for our policymakers.
That's the balancing act, and we had a good lesson in how it should not be done in 2013. We had the so-called taper tantrum when then-Chairman Bernanke used the T word, taper, to suggest that the Fed would start reducing its security purchases, and that caused all kinds of turmoil in financial markets, emerging markets in particular, because the Fed hadn't adequately communicated in advance what its intentions were. Nobody, either in the public sector or private sector, was prepared. I think policymakers have learned from that experience, and they've tried to communicate much more clearly what they intend to do. So that's what all that talk about, the other big word this year, patience, was a month ago when the Fed removed the word patience from its statement. They're trying to communicate as carefully as they can exactly what they're going to do and how they're going to do it far in advance, which will give markets and financial institutions and people time to prepare.
Well, let's turn to the economy at large now, and you talked about maybe some of the mistakes that were made by not pushing enough fiscal stimulus, enough public spending to foster a recovery at an earlier stage. However, at some point, we're far enough past the crisis to be able to say, this is no longer the aftermath. This is the new normal. This is the world we're living in. And it's a world that a lot of people feel very worried about. And some of the questions from our audience today pick up on, this new normal, the slow growth, the lack of job creation, and a sense that technology and automation are replacing jobs and that people feel insecure. So can we now put the Great Recession behind us? And should we be thinking about this as some kind of different and more difficult period than the one that came before?
Well, I think we have another difficult period ahead of us, 2-3% economic growth, which is what we can hope for now in the United States, is considerably slower than the economic growth that the countries enjoyed in the second half of the 20th century. So part of that reflects changing demographics in the United States. I think part of it reflects the fact that we haven't done a better job in terms of education and training. So that's my fourth mea culpa, if you will. I'm criticizing my own industry, education, if you will, for not better equipping Americans with the skills, the education, the training they need to compete in a global economy. We have underinvested over a long period in infrastructure. The government now invests considerably less in basic research than it did in prior decades. All of those things, education, infrastructure, basic research, are important determinants of how fast the economy can grow. And I think we could do more in terms of addressing those needs. We haven't done a very good job at creating the good jobs that people demand if they're going to stay in the labor market. So we've seen an extraordinary decline in the labor force participation rate in the United States. Not only did young people stay out of the labor market and old people drop out of the labor market in the Great Recession, but a bunch of people in the 25 to 55-year-old category dropped out of the labor market as well. I interpret that as what economists refer to as labor market polarization, that we haven't been able to create good middle-class jobs for those people who don't particularly want to be hamburger flippers. So they have dropped out of the labor market, and they or their successors will drop back in only if we're able to create the good jobs that education, training, et cetera, equip people.
So with the right investment in these areas, you are confident that it is possible to create well-paying jobs. This isn't some structural change that is simply going to, you know, devour the U.S.
No, I don't think it's globalization. I don't think it's robots. I think there are plenty of needs that can still only be satisfied in the 21st century economy by real live human beings who will be well compensated and have interesting jobs if we equip them with the skills that they will need in that future economy. The one additional thing I would say is that we created this problem in the U.S. economy not only as a result of the financial crisis, but over a considerable period of time. If we created this problem over the course of a couple of decades, we're not going to be able to solve it in only a couple of years.
Yeah. The other side of the coin of this current sense of insecurity is the great income inequality and wealth inequality that has become apparent in the last few years. And again, we've had a few questions on that from the audience, and let me just read one to you. What parallels do you see between the economic inequality we have today and that of the pre-Depression era? And what do you see as the future implications of this income inequality we're currently living with?
So we had the Gilded Age at the end of the 19th century. We had growing inequality, about which many observers were worried in the 1920s as well. And then we had what economic historians refer to as the Great Compression in the third quarter of the 20th century, when we did two things. We were able to create those good jobs as the United States being the technological leader of the world, and we had a more progressive tax policy as well. So I have colleagues like Emmanuel Seaz at Berkeley who are the experts on this subject. I'm not an inequality scholar per se, but as I read their work, technology and globalization has contributed to the growth of inequality in the United States, but so has tax policy. And a more progressive tax system with higher marginal tax rates on high-income earners could go a considerable distance toward addressing these worries about inequality without, at the same time, stifling economic growth.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program now where there's only time for one last question, so I'm actually going to combine two questions in one. And I think there's a lot of interest in how well our economic leaders and our financial leaders have performed. So I'm going to ask you to rate, and you've got to be very direct about this, I want you to rate some policymakers for us. Tell us what you really think. And these are questions from our audience, so I'm only the conduit here. So Mario Draghi at the ECB, who has prevented a worse crisis by saying he'll do whatever it takes to save the euro. What do you think of him, a plus or a minus?
We have no great inflation at Berkeley. I'd give Mr. Draghi an A minus.
Minus Mr. Draghi. Well, he's not
no, an A minus.
An A minus. There we are. And Ben Bernanke, he was, like you, a student of the Depression, a great economic historian. So will people in future, how will they look back on him and how he did in the wake of the last recession?
I think he deserves at least a B-plus for his response to the crisis, but I would remind you that he was also on the Federal Reserve Board and therefore an important regulator before the crisis, so you can draw your own conclusions about that.
What grade do you give him for his regulation?
Well, I would give him a failing grade for the regulatory efforts before the crisis, and much better since.
Very good. Well, our thanks to Dr. Barry Eichengreen, the Professor of Economics and Political Science at the University of California at Berkeley, and author of the new book, Hall of Mirrors, The Great Depression, The Great Recession, and the Uses and Misuses of History. And we also thank our audiences here and on the radio and the internet. I want to remind everyone here that copies of Professor Eichengreen's book are on sale at the back of the room, and he'll be pleased to sign them in this room following the program. I'm Richard Waters of the Financial Times, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.